Hello and welcome to another World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. Hitler, when he came to power, had very few international connections and he distrusted elements of his own civil service. What he needed was people he could trust who were connected to the highest echelons of power throughout Europe. These emissaries would be used to sound out opinion and smooth over incidents when they happened. And that's what we're going to be looking at in this episode, these back channels, the aristocratic go-betweens that Hitler employed. But before we get there, if you do enjoy my eclectic look at World War II, why not become a patron of the podcast? You might buy a history magazine each month. How long will you spend reading it? An hour? Two? I provide around 2 hours of podcast each month for free. And for patrons, sometimes a little bit more. This is all made possible from listeners like yourself becoming patrons of the show and donating a dollar or two each month. To find out how it works, you can find me on Patreon at patreon.com/ww2podcast or click on donate on the website ww2podcast.com. Right, so joining me today is Karina Urbach. Karina is currently working at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. Her book, Go-Betweens for Hitler, was published in 2015. Karina, thank you for joining me. Shall we start by defining what we mean by go-betweens, these back channels?
Well, it's important to understand that these are private individuals. They are not diplomats, and they are people in high places. They are useful to politicians and to statesmen because they are connected internationally with their counterparts in other countries. So that's why everybody used them. You know, they were used in by monarchs, by democratically elected governments, and also later on by dictators. I mean, Hitler used them a lot too, and they were useful because you could disown them if something went wrong, if the back channel didn't work. And you said, I've never, ever instructed this person. I don't know who you're talking about. And because they were discreet and loyal and had their own code of honor. So, yes, they were ideal. And because the nobility was so internationally connected, they were the ones that did all this go-between work until 39. I mean, today, of course, go-betweens are completely different people. You wouldn't use the nobility anymore. Now you would use businessmen who are internationally connected or scientists. It's very funny because here in Princeton, I met Freeman Dyson, a physicist, and he told me that during the Cold War, it was scientists, you know, who were used behind the scenes for talking to Russians. So, I mean, the method is never going away. We can see it with Trump at the moment, this North Korea, that he used people as go-betweens and so on. So it is still there. It was just that in the period I looked at, it was the nobility that was best connected and used.
And scientists, presumably, because that you can move them between international conferences without being seen.
That's right.
And it's probably the same for those aristocrats pre-war when they're going to various social functions around Europe between their relatives.
That they are exactly, yeah, because they were visiting their family or cousins abroad, and nobody ever asked any questions. And the interesting thing is that women were used a lot, and that's of course surprising because, you know, women didn't play any part in diplomacy until 45. I think only the Russians had one female diplomat, and that was so shocking for the British when she first arrived. You know, the king had to receive her as the new ambassador from the Soviet Union, and he was saying, yeah, but she's a woman, you know, I can't receive a woman ambassador. That has never happened. So for us, of course, this is bizarre today, but that women could play a part in this clandestine work before the Second World War, that was, yeah, new, novel.
How did they go about it? I mean, what was the procedure for the, you know, the way this works? I sort of have in my mind sort of a cross between sort of, I don't know if you've read P.G. Woodhouse and those parties that Bertie Wooster gets sort of invited to, but something with a bit more gravitas of sort of Downton Abbey. Is that where they sort of orchestrated meetings?
Yeah, that's pretty much. I mean, they had all these country house meetings, and that's you know, we know that from Remains of the Day, and it's a wonderful novel. And but they actually did take place. And for example, with the Duke of Coburg, whose sister is related to Queen Mary and George V, she invited everyone to her little country house. Nobody, of course, would have suspected anything, but she invited the Duke of Coburg, her brother, and Ribbentrop there, and mixed them with British politicians, with appeasers. So this was all low-key. This was totally off the radar, and no politician on the other side, or anti-appeasers, or any journalist would ever hear about it. So that was really well done. And in the First World War, they met a lot in Switzerland, in neutral countries, of course, and it was just, I have a few cases where, you know, they meet in a hotel lobby, you know, a female aristocrat and somebody from the French and the British side. So, yes, it was all done very, very properly and behind the scenes, but definitely behind the scenes.
You mentioned the Duke of Coburg. He started life as Charles Edward. That's not how he ended it, though.
Yes, I mean, he is a really bizarre case because he was ordered by Queen Victoria to take over the duchies of Coburg and Gotha. And when he was only 15, he was a schoolboy at Eton. And he was just unlucky in some ways because actually his uncle should have inherited them, but he didn't want to go to Coburg. So this little Charles Edward was sent over, and he changed his name from Charles Edward into Karl Eduard. So he became really German. And it was a sort of re-education program, but it went totally wrong in many ways because he really turned into the worst nationalist German you can imagine. And during the First World War, he distanced himself from the British royal family. He is actually the trigger for them changing their name into Windsor, because that's something that is never told. And I find that really bizarre. Then he is the one who first kicks the British relatives out of the House of Sachsen-Coburg-Gotha. He says during the war in 1917, he says they are no longer members of the House of Sachsen-Coburg-Gotha. And then, of course, George V has to react to that because he has lost his name, and he has many other problems at that time as well, because Gotha bombers have bombed Britain, of course, but he hasn't got a name anymore, so he has to change it into Windsor. Yes, it's this little Duke of Coburg who plays a very sinister part in the 20s and 30s, and then becomes, you know, Freikorps. He supports them financially. There are all these reactionary right-wing groups in Germany in the 20s, and then he falls in love with Hitler and finances him. So, yes, a very dark figure.
I wondered if with the First World War, he sort of felt he had to become almost like a super patriot to prove his Germanness, and then he almost got suckered into it, you know, as things went on.
Yeah. I was involved with some TV documentary that was about 10 years ago, and they were very sympathetic to him. They said, oh, this poor man, you know, it wasn't really his choice. He was sent over there. And of course, that does play a part. I mean, must have been a culture shock, but not that much of a culture shock when he came over, because his mother was German and he had all these German relatives and so on. But I think he was really characterized, not a very good person either. So it wasn't just, you know, bad luck. It was his character. He could have been more democratic, like many other former dukes in Germany. I mean, they didn't become proper Democrats, but they didn't become Nazis either. So he had a choice. You know, he had a choice.
How did it work? So how did it work for him? Did he does Hitler approach him, or did he approach Hitler to become a go-between? I mean, in some respects, the pairing of the two almost seems, you know, you've got the one hand of the revolutionary Hitler, and about someone as aristocratic almost as you can be, they're kind of the odd couple.
That's something that is so fascinating about the NSDAP, the Nazi Party, is playing to all sides. So there are people like Strasser and Goebbels who absolutely loathe the nobility, and they are more on the left for a long time. I mean, Goebbels then changes his ways, but Hitler doesn't care. I mean, he, as long as it's helping his party, party as long as they give money. He creeps up to everyone in the 20s. You know, he tries all these industrialists because he wants their money. He tries the German nobility. He chats up everyone, and they fall for him because he says he's anti-Bolshevist, and that's what they want to hear. And he charms them. He says how much he admires the traditions of the nobility and so on. And they do support him tremendously. And Karl Eduard is not the only one. I mean, especially aristocratic women, for some reason, I don't know, fall in love with Hitler. It's pretty disgusting. Yeah. And then, sorry, you asked about how does he use him? Well, yeah, because Hitler doesn't have, of course, when he starts off in the 20s and also until 33, he doesn't have any international contacts, you know, to people like Mussolini. He sends over Goering to Italy because he wants Goering to charm Mussolini, but that doesn't work at first. So what he does, and it's super clever of him, is he uses the House of Hessen, which is a German aristocratic family, and their ties to Italy, for example, and they make it possible because they have Italian, they have one of them is married to the daughter of the Italian king, so they can make it possible for Hitler to get into contact with Mussolini, and they are the icebreakers, and they really give him the international contacts that he lacks.
Is the civil service aware at all of what's going on with these these aristocrats sort of floating around Europe?
The German Foreign Office is, of course, yeah, at first they are full of conservative people. There are some Nazis in the German Foreign Office, but not enough, according to Hitler. And he's trying to infiltrate them, and he absolutely succeeds. I mean, he doesn't trust his own Foreign Office. That's one reason why he uses these back channels and uses the nobility, because he trusts the House of Hessen and Coburg and Hohenzollern. They also work for him. So he trusts them completely, but he doesn't trust his own diplomats. But then, of course, during the 30s, the diplomats completely turn around and support Hitler, and Weizsäcker is a famous case. And he doesn't have to worry about them not being loyal. But it does take some time before the Foreign Office. And, of course, the Foreign Office is terribly jealous of these go-betweens. They do find out. For example, there is a Bismarck, the grandson of the famous Otto von Bismarck. He is in London, and he is very upset when the Duke of Coburg is turning up, running back channels with Ribbentrop, and is jealous. He's just jealous. But then, of course, he outshines him by becoming the super Nazi himself. So creeping up to the new emperor, the new court. Hitler is the new emperor, so they become his courtiers again. I mean, they are good at being courtiers. That's what the nobility is trained to be.
Well, it amused me when the Duke of Coburg manages to be in London every time something happens. You would have thought if somebody had been watching him, they could figure out that Hitler was about to do something because the Duke's in town.
Yeah, that's right. And he was, I mean, when you look at him, yeah, you would recognize him anywhere. So it is suspicious. So he's doing this country house hopping, and he's staying with his sister and trying to hide. But some go-betweens, of course, like Stephanie Hohenlohe, they were picked up. They were on the journalist's radar, and that is, in her case, is a problem for her, because one of them sees her coming out of Halifax's private home, and that's the end of her work, because after that she has been outed and she can never work again as a go-between.
Well, she's interesting because although she's working for the Germans, she's also paid for by British press magnate Lord Rothermere, isn't she?
That's right. I mean, this woman is unbelievable. She always finds somebody who pays for her, and she's financed by so many people. It's very difficult to find out. She never did a tax return, so we won't know who, and she might not have declared it anyway. So she always got these presents, so I guess jewelry and so on, you don't have to declare. So, yeah, she's starting off very early in the 20s, and she's first paid by Rothermere, then also the Hungarians are paying her, and then she manages to be paid by Hitler. But the idea was that Lord Rothermere, the Daily Mail owner, of course, wanted to get in contact with Hitler. I mean, first he wants to get in contact with the emperor, because Rothermere has this big idea to get the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns back on the throne, but he gives up that idea and then turns to the new people, the dictators.
It struck me as being rather pragmatic in some respects, because some of the, you know, obviously some of these aristocratic families will have suffered at the end of the First World War, presumably with their properties being divided up between various nations.
Yeah.
Often they're in terminal decline because the money is now elsewhere. And it struck me as being rather pragmatic if you can latch on to being one of these go-betweens, because it gives you a sort of power and status that you might not otherwise have fiscally, considering what's happening in the business world.
Absolutely right, yeah. For them, the revolution is such a shock in 1918, and losing, for example, many people had property in Hungary, all the Austrian nobility, of course, and now they have lost that, or they had property in Schlesien, which is now Polish, and the Pless family is fighting for this Polish property for ages. And there is also this, they have no more status. I mean, that is so demeaning for them to be just normal citizens now and to understand. I mean, it is a horrible shock for them. And of course, they associated with Bolshevism, and that is their biggest threat in the 20s and 30s. And of course, they are very anti-Semitic, or becoming very anti-Semitic, because they think Bolshevism, well, that means Jews. They are obviously running that show, so they become even more anti-Semitic than before.
I can't find it. I did make a note of, I wonder if these people are more, you know, it's Hobson's choice, if they, you know, it's an aversion to communism rather than an affection to the Hitler and the Nazi party is the greater driving force.
Yes, yeah, definitely, yeah. And that I think that's also the case in England, because you have this feeling in the 1920s that, you know, the empire is getting undermined by communism, and of course that's not completely untrue, not at all. I mean, there are the idea is of Lenin to have a world communism, and of course they are trying to hit Britain in the empire, and they have all these Comintern information about what is going on in Afghanistan, that the communists are getting weapons in India, etc., etc. So they are absolutely right to fear it. That they turn that far to the right in reaction to it is, of course, the consequence, and not the best consequence. I mean, but it explains the appeasement policies of Chamberlain, and that he doesn't want to talk to the Russians.
I mean, it's sort of been British, it's the elephant in the room. So how does this fit in with the British royal family? Because they were a prime target for these go-betweens as they come to Britain.
Yeah, they were really the prime target. And the Duke of Coburg uses his links. He uses the relationship that he, you know, is also a grandson of Queen Victoria. He uses his sister, because his sister, Alice Athlone, is married to Queen Mary's brother. So it's a bit complicated. So Queen Mary is a tech, and she has a brother, and the brother marries the Duke of Coburg's sister. So he is the one who gives the Duke of Coburg a lot of PR in England. He gives him the country house whenever he wants to turn up there with Ribbentrop. So the Duke of Coburg has a lot of conversations with the Prince of Wales, the later Edward VIII, and of course also helps him when he's Duke of Windsor to have this big PR tour of Germany in 37. But yes, he does try to use his influence on the royal family, and he is received by Queen Mary, naturally, and is coming to Sandringham after Christmas and things like that. So he is in England all the time and uses all his contacts. And the royal family is, you know, very hospitable to him. And he, of course, he's not the only German relative who sells Hitler to them. I mean, he paints Germany in the most rosy picture. And that's the same thing the House of Hessen does. The Duke of Hessen, who also very closely related, and the Hohenzollern, who also come over. And then the Duke of Coburg also has this close connection with the veterans group in Britain, and of course with the Anglo-German Fellowship. So they try it on several levels to influence the British appeasers.
What I found interesting was the concentration, perhaps, on trying to nobble the royal family onto sort of winning them over. Because I wondered if it showed a lack, I might be wrong, but a lack of a kind of where Britain was politically, because ultimately power didn't at all lie with the royal family, and I'm not sure really how much they could sway the government if the government chose to do its own thing. Obviously, the royal family had nothing to do. But I wonder if that doesn't come across sort of necessarily from a dictatorial Germany at the time. Does that make sense?
Oh, I see. Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, it has often been said, you know, Hitler totally had this overblown view that the royal family is still pulling the strings and so on and so forth. And of course, they are not. I mean, they are in the they can only do things or influence indirectly behind the scenes and so on and so forth. But they are. I mean, in 38 and in the 30s, very much on Chamberlain. Side, and we know from Queen Mary that she does support the Munich Agreement, and she does support Chamberlain's peacemaking policies. We know from George VI that, of course, he does have a great interest in the Spanish monarchy coming back to Spain, so he is not critical of Franco. That is something important to know, because he is related to the Queen of Spain, who hopes that her son can come back, that Franco will call back the monarchy, which was everybody thought that at the time. So, I mean, they are not fascists at all, of course, but they have an interest in, of course, supporting these old families getting back into power and supporting on the continent authoritarian regimes and not necessarily democratic ones.
Appeasement's sort of a dirty word now, but I'm led to believe that I think it comes across, I might be wrong, in those mass observation reports that actually people were I'm not sure if the word appeasement was used at the time, but we're pro, you know, avoiding war at all costs. So, you know, the royal family may very well have been in step with public opinion, which perhaps Churchill, when it comes to power, isn't, but convinces everybody to follow him.
Yes, they were definitely in step with public opinion, and the majority was pro appeasement, and so yes, that's what they are following. Really, I think to understand why they were so pro appeasement is really important to know that it's because of their anti-communism, anti-Bolshevism, and they feel threatened not just at home, because the British, I mean, there's I think one communist in the House of Commons, so that is ridiculous, but they feel threatened in the empire, and they are right to feel threatened in India and in China, even though China is not part of the empire, but China is their biggest trading partner with India, so they feel threatened that communism will take over, and they have every interest in therefore supporting authoritarian or fascist regimes in other countries, and that is what they are doing behind the scenes.
Did they have any stunning victories? That's not necessarily stunning successes. That's the word I was looking for. Did they have any big coups, successes? These go-betweens?
In the First World War, of course, you know, the Germans weren't very successful with their go-between work. There was a big scandal with the Austrians. They had a go-between called Sixtus, Prince Sixtus, and when he was uncovered, it played a role in the Habsburg downfall, really. There were successes, for example, for the Duke of Coburg, when he is a go-between during the naval agreement in 35, and he sees, of course, the Rhineland demilitarization in 36 as a big success. But there are lots of people who claim that they were the ones, like Hirsch and the ambassador Hirsch, and so on and so forth. So, yes, I mean, they had short-term successes, certainly, yeah.
I presume the British must have done the same in reverse. Who is working for the British in Germany?
Ah, yeah. Well, that is, of course, more on the spy side then. So, yeah, I think that there is this very interesting figure. He's called Christie. He is working as a naval attaché in Germany. And he works as a go-between for Chamberlain and von Sittard for a while. And he also is involved with peace talks in the 1930s. 1940, when, you know, during the phony war, they still think that, you know, that there might be, it might be possible to get a peace deal. They sent a lot of people to Switzerland during that time, and there are also strange things happening in American hotel rooms in 1940. So yes, they use mainly military people to do these go between things.
So we weren't exporting our own nobility to Germany for
Well, you were in a way, because, for example, in 1939, there's the Duke of Kent coming over and working as a go-between, still hoping to avert war, which is, of course, for some people, that's something admirable. He is coming over, sent by George VI to talk to the Duke of Hessen, who reports to Hitler. So there are still, definitely high-ranking aristocrats coming over from the other side as well.
Were there countries where these go-betweens just didn't, these German go-betweens just didn't work? Yeah, I'm kind of thinking that, you know, perhaps the United States or perhaps France. You know,
France. Yeah, because it's republic. Yeah, it's a republic, and they couldn't really get to the top there. That's right. I mean, Stephanie Hohenlohe, for example, has horrible problems in France. She gets arrested once, and it's not her scene. But in America, she does try to work for Hitler, and the Duke of Coburg is sent to America, which is also very funny. But he does meet Roosevelt in Washington. And he also meets Molotov. So that's, of course, I think 39 he is over there. So, yes, so they are sent to, even the Duke of Coburg is sent to Soviet Union.
Stephanie Hohenlohe, she curiously ends up working for the OSS profiling Hitler. She sort of turned sides.
I know. But the poor man who, the OSS guy who has to interview her, she gets him into horrible trouble because she immediately, of course, wants to get out of prison. She's interned in America as an enemy alien. She says, I cooperate with you if you get me out of here. And he can't. And then she slacks him off and says horrible things about him and so on and so forth. But she was very useful. Of course, she was always lying so much. I don't know how much you have to deduct from her report about Hitler, but because she was so close to Hitler, and for some reason Hitler really was charmed by her. We don't know why, but she obviously had some impact on him, and so she is quite useful. And a lot of former Hitler admirers who flee to America, like Putzi Hamstenger, who was very close to Hitler in the 1920s, of course, try to explain him. And yeah, it's quite funny. She's one of the women. And then, of course, there is also another, the daughter of Winifred Wagner from the Wagner clan. She's also giving the OSS a profile on Hitler because she knew him since she was a child.
So what happened to all these people after the war? Presumably, they will have been picked up by the Allies.
Yeah, I mean, the Duke of Coburg is the only unlucky one in some regards, because he gets interned by the Americans, and he, of course, immediately complains, you know, says, oh, I'm related to Queen Victoria, get me out of here. And and then his sister, as usual, his sister descends on Germany and tries to get him. She writes a horrible report, letters home, saying, oh, you know, these Americans, there is this American Syrian guy, and then there is this Jewish guy, and how can they not release my wonderful brother, and how can they represent America? I mean, she more or less is snobbish and anti-Semitic, saying they are not good enough to be in charge of Germany. So she gets him out. She gets him out, and he then dies in the 1950s. And everybody says he was broke. I mean, he wasn't that broke, but he still had a house, and he was financially all right. The others did better. I mean, Stephanie Hohenlohe, she's amazing how she reinvented herself and then becomes a society hostess in America, and even works for the White House again. You know, after Roosevelt, during 1940, Roosevelt says, get rid of that horrible woman, you know, send her to Vladivostok, I can't see her anymore, she's troubled, she's dangerous, and so on. And then when Kennedy comes back into the White House, she somehow manages to become, you know, a go-between, a fixer in this. I mean, she is working for newspapers then, and she fixes an interview for German newspapers with Kennedy and Johnson, President Johnson as well, yeah. So it's amazing how she survived. And she dies in Geneva in the 70s, super rich and happy.
Again, pragmatism. You're fading out aristocracy. If you can float to the as close as possible to the circles of power, hopefully some of that will shine back on you to give you some sort of relevance in the in a changing world. How on earth did you manage to document all these off-the-book activities? Is it a matter of getting everyone's social diaries together and comparing dates?
Oh, it was really tough. I mean, because in Germany, they had all these denazification trials, of course, after 45. And that meant that lots of people burned everything that they could, would be incriminated. So it is very, I mean, the Bismarck family is difficult to get access to. The Coburgs had to burn a lot of stuff, but they, thank God, the Duke of Coburg had these little pocket diaries where he writes all the appointments. It's an appointment book, really, and he writes in who he saw and how long, and sometimes he writes what they talked about. So he saw the Queen Mother, your Queen Mother, who died, of course, Queen Elizabeth, and all these things. So he's pretty good. I mean, the biggest problem I had is this the Royal Archives, and that's why I'm still having this crusade for them to open up their papers, because it is quite outrageous that all these papers are still closed after so many years. For example, we have nothing on Edward VIII, on the Duke of Windsor. All his papers are closed. The Duke of Kent's papers are closed. We don't have them at all, and we know that he was in the 30s going to Germany a lot and talking to high-ranking Nazis. So I find it a bit shocking that nothing is happening on that front and that there's not more transparency, because the Royal Archives are also financed by British taxpayers' money.
Well, I was going to say, is it a private archive or is it, in theory, a public archive? In which case, does it sort of fall under those various rules like governmental archives, where you get your 50 years rule and your 100 years rule?
Ah, yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah, they don't have any rules. So, of course, you would say, will we ever see, Edward VIII's papers? I mean, do we have a chance in 100 years or in 150 years? And then they claim, no, we are a private archive. But, of course, it's not private, because this is the state papers of your kings and queens. It should be a public archive, and it should be not just official biographers who can access these important papers from the 1930s. I mean, the Royal Archives have released things, Queen Victoria's diaries, and that's wonderful, and it's digitalized and online, and that's very public spirited. But of course, they are very selective in releasing papers, and that is the shocking thing, that they are controlling this and that they are giving us no hope and no date when we can ever see these papers from the 1930s.
Is there a sort of a cut-off point where they start getting sensitive about what you can see? Can you see everything up to the start of the First World War?
Ah, that's difficult, because we don't know what they have. You see, they don't
let you in at the catalogue.
That's right. That's why, I did with my German colleagues, with John Davis and Franz Bosbach, we wanted to document all the, before 1914, we wanted to document all these papers they have for Anglo-German relations. So we did publish two catalogues on this, which was it cost the German taxpayer an enormous amount of money. It cost €500,000. So we did catalogue up to 1914 everything they showed us. We don't know whether it's everything they have. But when we asked, can we see papers for a later date? No. And of course, they have an internal catalog. They have a catalog, but that is not online, and nobody knows what is in this internal catalog. So we will never know what they have. And so what you can do is you can write to them and say, do you have anything on, 1917? And then they will write back to you and say, yes or no. So you have to trust them that they're telling you the truth.
So it's a bit like one of those Dan Brown books where he's talking about the Vatican archives and no one really knows what's in there.
Yeah. I mean, that's very similar. I mean, it's like the KGB archives. It's the same thing. You can't go in there, and you can write to them, but they probably won't reply at all. At least the Royal Archives do reply when they say no.
I was sort of on the assumption that up to a set date you'd be allowed in, and then it would be a rolling as people either passed away or over a set period of time you'd be allowed in.
No, unfortunately there's no room. And that is, I think, really the big problem. And that's why the Times and also the Guardian were running these campaigns and, you know, said, open up your archives. I mean, this is really hindering historical research. It's not that we are interested. I know they probably had affairs and illegitimate children and all that stuff. But I think we are not interested in that. I can understand that you want to hide these very intimate things, but it's political papers people are interested in and should have a right to see.
Indeed. Thanks, Corina. Let's leave it there. If you would like to discover more about the remarkable lives of these men and women who acted behind the scenes for Nazi Germany, Corina's book is Go-Betweens for Hitler. I'll put a link on the website, www.podcast.com. If you want more World War II, don't forget you can find me on Facebook, where I do post things in support of the latest episode. And don't forget, for patrons, I do release exclusive bits and pieces. And you can find me at patreon.com/WW2podcast or click on donate on the website, WW2podcast.com, and join the mailing list. That's it for now. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.